You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. My guest is Mark Elliott. He has written biographies of John Wayne, Steve McQueen, Phil Oakes, Charlton Heston, the Eagles, Jack Nicholson, Ronald Reagan, and Walt Disney. His new book is The Hag, The Life, Times, and Music of Merle Haggard. Mark Elliott, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
It's good to be back.
Your very first book was about Phil Oakes, the great folk singer of the 60s who died in 1976. The very first time I saw Phil Oakes, he performed a Merle Haggard song.
He was the first person to play Merle Haggard to me. I'd never heard of him. And for my birthday in 1971, Phil, that week, was doing a show at Hunter College in New York. And he said, it's your birthday. Let me sing a song for you. Tell me what you think. And we were down at his Prince Street apartment. In those days, you could have Prince Street apartments for no money. And he sat there and he sang Okey from Muskogee for me. And I was kind of shocked. First of all, that Phil would sing that song, and that he would be praising it instead of saying, oh, listen to this awful song. And as I listened to it and then heard it again the following night at the show, where the audience went wild for it and against it, I began to realize what Phil was talking about. This was a major songwriter. And years later, of any genre, rock, country, folk, this was a major voice. And years later, when I spoke to Merle about the song, he said that it was a song about pride. His father had been an Okie from Oklahoma, and was part of the great influx of the Okies and the Arkies to California, to Bakersfield and Oildale, where they were not well received. They were considered the way a lot of immigrants are considered today that come from other countries. Job takers, people who lower the life, the quality of life, and wherever they go, all that stuff. And he said his father was a very prideful man. And when all that happened to him, it only made him more prouder. And Merle always insisted that the song was about his father, who was a very important person in Merle's life. Yeah, there's a little nastiness in it, for sure. I'm not going to say it's the new version of the Bible, but that was Merle. I mean, Merle's humor could sometimes be a little bit vicious, like Fight Inside of Me. And it's a terrific song, the way it's done, but it's got a message. You know, it's got that love it or leave it message that my generation, back in the 60s, took as a war cry, as a surrender. If we left, we wanted to stay here and fight. So that, it's difficult to place him in one style of music or one theme in his music, except I think the death of his father, his inability to find a woman who was as good as his mother. Like Freud said, I want a girl just like the girl who married dear old dad. I mean, that's the essence of Freudian guilt and all desire. Merle's self-destructive nature was that he kept on choosing women who couldn't be that, couldn't be Flossie May, except Bonnie Owens, who came very, very close, and Merle managed to ruin that as well. So if you're looking for a theme, and as you mentioned throughout all my books, it usually there's something about an underdog who manages to overcome his world, and fathers, fathers who leave a distinct mark or scar on their children's future. And that certainly carries through here. You can see it in Cary Grant. You can see it in certainly in Steve McQueen, Jack Nicholson. There is that theme that I want to get into people's lives. What makes them great? You know, I'm never interested in writing, and then he was in, and then he was in, or then he wrote, then he wrote. I'm interested in character. And Murrow was certainly somebody who was like a 100-pound wedding cake of character. And I just wanted to dive into it and eat my way out, you know.
Well, you know, it did seem, not that I haven't always enjoyed your books, but it felt like this book, you had a sort of more passion for this book than maybe you've had for a couple of other books.
Well, that's absolutely right. I wouldn't disagree with you. You know, every book that you hit can't be out of the ballpark. I mean, you hit a single, a double, a triple, a pop out. But this one, this is my 26th book. And the very first book I wrote, Death of a Rebel, has Merle in it. In this book about Merle Haggard, you have Phil in it. So there was a special kind of sense of completing a circle. But beyond that, what really stirred the pot was getting to know Merle's crowd and family on a one-to-one basis. The access I had was extraordinary for a biography like this, beginning with Ken Burns and Dayton Dalton, who wrote Burns's Benjamin Franklin series that's currently on. Ken turned me over to Dayton. Dayton turned me over to Frank Mull, each giving me extraordinary information. And Mull, who was Merle's best friend, who you never heard of because Merle never mentioned him in his memoirs or anywhere, but he was the closest to Merle. He then turned me on to Dwight Yoakam and just Marty Stewart, members of the band who had been with Merle for 40 years, the fellow who discovered Merle first, Fuzzy Owen. So the access to these real people in living terms was just an amazing thing for me. Usually when people are dead and you're writing about them, you have to go to archives and things like that. Merle passed away 5 years ago, 6 years ago now. And January 6th, tomorrow is where talking is Merle's birthday. So, you know, there's a certain feeling on my part that with this book, I really did it. I got him. And it's a long book, but I think it reads like a thriller. There's prison, there's crime, there's sex, there's drugs, you know, there's everything that you could possibly want in a biography.
It does go by very quickly. It's not intimidating in length in any way. And in addition to cameos from Phil Oakes, Don Henley is in the book, and you've written about him. And Ronald Reagan is in the book, and you've written about him. A lot of your people. Do you feel a connection to all the people you've written about? Like they, a proprietary feeling about them?
I'm not sure it's proprietary, but I do feel I have to like people before I write about them, because you're going to spend 2 or 3 years of your life. Either in a good marriage or a bad marriage. You know, I'm somebody who, I liked Ronald Reagan, but not because of his politics, because of his history before he got into politics, his Hollywood history, and that's what I wanted to write about.
Yeah, your book on Reagan has nothing to do with his political career.
It ends where that begins. And with John Wayne, I consider John Wayne the first, second, or third best actor whoever crossed the American screen, due mostly to John Ford, who we all revere as an American giant. And so the Ford Wayne connection for me elevates John Wayne into the stratosphere of great American actors. Cary Grant, someone who started off with nothing, crossed the ocean, came to America, very much like Charlie Chaplin did, kind of modeled his early life around Chaplin. And, you know, what he went through, I could identify with what I went through in my early years of trying to write. I get that. Plus, I think he was, of all the British expats, they called them the Beverly Brits. To me, he was the most talented. His physicality, because of his early training as an acrobat, so interesting, and made him such a good actor. James Stewart, what can I say? Vertigo is my favorite movie, and his real life of heroism, so fascinating, his choice of movies as he went along. And there's just nobody like him. Andrew Saras called him the most complete American actor. And that is kind of what I based the biography on, the idea that he was the most complete American actor. You know, Phil Oakes, close friend of mine, helped change the village scene. Got lost in the great exodus that took place when Dylan left. But these are people I either grew up with, knew, loved, admired, or wondered about. And having had the chance to write real books about them, big, real, you know, blockbuster books, it's a good feeling. It's a good feeling for me to have done something my mother might have been proud of had she lived. Said, "Oh, my boy made something." You know, when I told my mother when I was a kid I wanted to be a writer, I remember she started crying.
Like crying like you won't get a real job, or with pride?
After that, you know, what about law school? You know, it just didn't resonate with me. She didn't live to see the big successes. She saw a little bit of it, but not much of it. Nor did my grandmother, who was my biggest, my first girlfriend, you might say. She was the greatest woman who ever lived, modestly. And so the drive to do real stories comes from the people I admired so much who lived real lives. And so you don't want to belittle that, as so many of these biographies do with gossip and suggestive things, no research, no knowledge of the subject. I always delve into what I'm doing. I've always been a country music lover. I just really never got into Merle until Phil turned me on to him. I mean, Hank Williams was somebody I just, you know, played every day of my teenage life.
Well, I was suspecting that you might want to write about Dylan because of the role that he plays in this book and the way you talk about him. I'm thinking there'll be a Dylan biography.
There are so many books about Bob Dylan that I wouldn't want to get into that crowd.
You don't think there needs to be 46,001 books?
I think there needs to be one.
That's right. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're chatting this week with Mark Elliott, the New York Times best-selling biographer. His new book is called The Hag, The Life, Times, and Music of Merle Haggard. He's also written about Steve McQueen, John Wayne, Jack Nicholson, Ronald Reagan, Walt Disney, and many others. Mark Elliott, many of your books have generated controversy, even your biography of Walt Disney.
People think of Walt Disney and they think of Mickey Mouse, and that's one and the same guy. As a matter of fact, he did Mickey's voice for many years. And, you know, hi, kid, that was all Walt Disney. But he's not Mickey Mouse. He was a complex artist. And in order to tell that story, you've got to leave behind the awe and the fawning to get to the real story. You know, I did it. I had great source material, including the Freedom of Information Act file on Disney, which was like the New York phone book. people whose lives were affected by Disney. The book caused a controversy, I guess, because people didn't want to hear anything about Walt Disney except the wonderful world of Disney. And, you know, I always take the criticism or the praise with a kind of a, okay, you know, that's what you think, and that's okay. I almost never read reviews anymore because they just, it's like reading a film review where the reviewer tells you the story of the film. Well, to me, that has nothing to do with the film when you're reviewing it. And so when people review books, they usually go through the life and then they say, oh, and his writing was good or his writing was not good. And then, you know, they almost try to compete with what you've written about to show that they know more. You know, I've written criticism. I'm not completely innocent from that. And I'm not insensitive to constructive criticism. But, you know, popular criticism, popular culture, there's a kind of a vulturistic feel about people who actually write about it. Amazingly, Merle has gotten great reviews. I mean, just, excuse me, Merle has gotten great reviews, and the reception has been, for me, surprising. My books are usually more controversial, not by aim, just by the result. But this one, everybody seems to really love it. And that's a good feeling for me because everybody should love Merle Haggard.
It definitely sends you to the racks to find the music that you discuss. And you definitely want to hear it. I kind of wish it has a compilation CD with it or something, but you do give a good, a flawless discography of stuff to listen to as you go along, which I appreciate.
A couple of people have said that to me. People who have never listened to Merle, a friend of mine said, you know, I started reading the book and every time a song came up, I'd put it on and listen to it. So it became like a soundtrack. And I think that in this book that happens. Mostly for people who don't really know Merle that much.
He did have a beautiful voice. And one thing that I loved that you discussed in the book, when I first heard, I've always liked Merle Haggard's voice and thought it was great. And then later I discovered Lefty Frizzell. I was really too young to have ever really paid any attention to Lefty Frizzell. And as soon as I heard Lefty Frizzell, I said, wait a minute. That's Merle Haggard. That Merle Haggard really, you know, does his singing voice is Lefty Frizzell's voice almost.
Well, it's Lefty Frizzell. It's part Lefty, part Hank Williams, part Jimmy Rogers, and part Bob Wills. And so he's an amalgam. And he says at one point, I took some of this from Lefty, some of this from Hank, some of it from Bing Crosby, who could hear Bing Crosby in Merle's voice, and created his own sound. You know, when he was 16, he went to a Lefty Frizzell concert in Bakersfield, and through a whole series of events that are in the book, he wound up getting on stage and singing a song of Lefty's. And people thought it was Lefty Frizzell. You know, Lefty, who was drunk by then, heard it and then came on stage. Isn't this kid great? And then got him off the stage. So, you know, there is definitely, you know, that Lefty thing of and Merle's doing the very same thing, you know, in his songs. But that's what, you know, that's what people do. That's how they learn. In later years, Merle's shows would begin with a Jimmy Rogers song, and then he would do a Hank Williams, and then he would do a Bob Wills, and then he would do a Lefty Frizzell. He was a great teacher. He wanted to show people the real country music, what it was, and where he fit in. And so after doing those, he would start singing his own songs, and it made for a fantastic show. He never forgot where he came from, musically, historically, culturally, in terms of his parents. And that's, I think, part of what makes him such a great artist and someone you really want to learn about. He is America in a sense, just as much as Bob Dylan is American culture. He is just as much that, and an important figure of our times.
Well, Johnny Cash recorded a lot of, I guess you would really call them concept albums, long before there was Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. There were these Johnny Cash albums. And although Merle didn't do that as much, he did a lot of tribute albums that I really loved throughout his career, and especially the one to Bob Wills, which was wonderful. That was one of the great albums.
Wills was supposed to be a part of it, and of course died the second day that they were working on it. He did a great Jimmy Rogers tribute album, just beautiful. When you hear it, it's almost unearthly. It's so beautiful and hard to imagine that these songs were written in the 20s, in the 30s. Merle makes them so contemporary. He did do a couple of prison albums, one of them for his third wife, Leona Williams. But he was uneasy doing them. There's a section in the book, or a little piece in the book, where he goes back to San Quentin, where Merv Griffin makes a documentary of him, of all people, taking him back to San Quentin. And someone told me, I think it was Ronnie Reno, who also was a musician, is a musician, and knew Merle very well, that Merle asked if he could go back to his cell, the cell that he was in for almost 3 years. And he knew all the guards by then. They were all familiar faces. And they said, sure. And they brought him up there. And Reno said he sat there and he went somewhere. He just went somewhere that nobody but Merle knew where it was. And he just sat there for a while and then got up and said, okay, let's move on. So there, you know, it's a very poignant moment, and it reveals a lot of Merle by what you don't know what he's thinking, as opposed to surmising what he's thinking. Sometimes you just have to let the mystery of people's lives be there. You know, his life was changed, you know, by a Johnny Cash prison album. In 1959, New Year's Day, Merle had already been in San Quentin over 2 years, and was even there running stills out of his cell, you know, just incorrigible. But he eventually was allowed to join the prison band, and the warden came to like him and let him go to see this show. And as Johnny was up there doing his great stuff, Merle sat in his seat and said, you know, I don't want to be this jerk down here. I want to be that guy up there. And 8 years later, Merle was the biggest star in country music. And that 8 years, it forms a lot of what this book is, how you go from nothing to something. A lot of the book is about the childhood, what the loss of the father did, and then the big years, and then the falling down, you know, it's a show business life, and then being resurrected. One of the people who resurrected him was Bob Dylan by putting him on a never-ending tour. So it's just a great story. It's an epic, and I loved writing it. Even, you know, it got me through the pandemic, because a writer loves nothing more than not being able to get up and get away from.
That's right. It was helpful. Well, thank goodness we had the pandemic, but I did see Merle Haggard in concert once, and he was very good. I was supposed to see him another time at the Bridge concert, Neil Young's Bridge concerts, but he was ill and couldn't make it, and Kris Kristofferson performed for him, and we thought, Merle's at death's door, but then he came back and was around for another 15 years or something. But
Well, he was a strong guy. You know, he had lung cancer. Beat it in the sense that, you know, he survived for another 10 years, but he never really got rid of it. But, you know, he played up until the day he couldn't do it anymore, and stopped at the hospital in Bakersfield, and then wanted to be put on his bus. He wanted to die on his bus and predicted the day he would die. He predicted he would die on his birthday at 8 o'clock in the morning. And sure enough, surrounded by some family and friends, and went to the next band.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're chatting this week with Mark Elliott, the New York Times best-selling biographer. His new book is called The Hag, The Life, Times, and Music of Merle Haggard. He's also written about Steve McQueen, John Wayne, Jack Nicholson, Ronald Reagan, Walt Disney, and many others.
Well, in the photo section of your book, The Hag, The Life, and Times, and Music of Merle Haggard, there's a picture of Merle Haggard standing next to Mark Elliott.
Yes. I don't know how that got in. That was in 1992 when Merle was in Branson and I was writing Roy Clark's biography with him.
Oh, uh-huh.
And, you know, Clark was another guy who had a big hotel and loved to work on his bus. And so we wrote that whole book on his bus. And in Branson, if you're familiar with it, all the acts do two shows a day. And the audience comes to them. It's after they've been a lifetime of touring. It's very attractive. I saw Roy twice a day, every day, perform the same exact show. So at the end of one show, one night, he said, "Now, who else do you want to see? Who's around? You can see anybody you want." And I said, "Well, I see Merle Haggard's in town. I'd love to go see him." And Roy said, "Merle Haggard? Why would you want to see Merle Haggard?" Because Roy was anything but an outlaw. He was, you know, everybody's pal. But it's okay, if you want to see him, I'll call up his people and they'll take care of you. So I went down to see him and he put on an incredible program for half an audience. And went backstage to meet him. And that's when I first got to know him. And yeah, I told them about Phil Oakes, and that's where that "who the hell is Phil Oakes" quote comes from. We talked for quite a while about music. He was gracious, friendly, and someone took that picture of us, which I treasure. The pictures I think are maybe a touch more important in the book, not much, but a touch more important, are his childhood pictures. This picture with Obama from the Kennedy Center Awards and with Paul McCartney.
That's a great picture of him and Paul McCartney.
Yeah. The family gave me those pictures. It just emphasizes how far he came from being this junior James Dean punk, who nasty, robbing, running away from home, taking up with young girls, all of it. To this champion of a generation, to someone who overcame it and is standing with, you know, one of the world's great songwriters, who I think Merle just as great with Paul McCartney and with Obama. You know, that's
just, for an ex-con, that's pretty amazing.
That's right. For an ex-con, he didn't do too bad. He didn't open that liquor store, you know, in Palmdale. He went to the top, and you know, nobody who goes to the top takes the superhighway. You always take the back road, and when you slide down the superhighway, and then you have to crawl your way up again. So it's a saga, and fortunately, I had enough access, great access, to be able to get the real story as I see it. And I'm very happy with it. They're very happy with it.
Well, I loved hearing that the reason that he was in prison, I guess, I mean, there are many things he did, but the main reason he went to prison was breaking into a restaurant that was actually open. He could have just walked in.
He and his friends were drunk, and they were robbing gas stations, cars, and Merle got the idea to rob this grocery store, this restaurant. He figured there'd be a lot of money in the till at the end of the day. It was a grocery and a restaurant. So they figured out, go in the back, break in the back way so nobody will know. Meanwhile, the place was open. when the owner heard this noise in the back, this door being broken into, he walked back there and said, hey, guys, why don't you use the front door? We're all... And that, of course, led to Merle being brought in front of the same judge. It's a small town, Bakersfield. It's one or two judges. And it was the same judge 17 times that he came before. And finally, this judge said, I'm going to send you someplace where you might be able to learn how to behave. And that was San Quentin. So before he was 20 years old, he was in San Quentin, the big house. And as Dwight Yoakam said in talking about Merle for the book, you never leave. You never leave San Quentin. Once you're there, you're in for life. And I thought, so perfect a description, because Merle never again was able to trust anybody, to love the way he had loved before. He allowed very few people to get close to him, Frank Moe being one of them. He was always looking over his shoulder. In his bus, he slept in the back, and he had mirrors up so he could see if anybody was coming. You know, prison does that to you, state prison. And it certainly did it to him, but in a strange way, it also enhanced his music. It made his music deeper. So he was a deep fellow who began to acknowledge his own depth and his own ability. You know, he wrote without metaphors. He was the anti-Dylan. You try to figure out that mystic, who is he? Who is this guy? You know, who is the geek? But Merle's writing was very much like Robert Frost's. If we make it through December, everything will be all right, I know. It's the coldest time of winter, and I shiver when I see the morning snow. Robert Frost, whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. Will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. So this idea of death and coldness and fatal fortunes are very similar in both their poems. They're very American. And neither one of them was big on metaphors. They just painted very clear pictures. And as I say somewhere in the book, if Merle had been a poet rather than a songwriter, he'd be in the pantheon of American letters. But, he was a songwriter. He was a singer and a songwriter. And except for Dylan, I'm not really sure how many singer-songwriters get to that level of sustainability and greatness and all of that. So
he wrote some very beautiful melodies as well as beautiful lyrics. And his songs have been pretty well covered. I mean, there's so many different Merle Haggard versions of Silver Wings, and
yeah,
that's been recorded by many artists. And so
Today
many.
I Started Loving You Again. Yeah. Covered by everybody. Holding Things Together, which I think is his most beautiful song. It's just two or three choruses about, and you get the whole picture of the marriage and the failure of it. And it's, as you say, the melody is so, so beautiful. And then you have the other, you have songs like White Line Fever, which is obviously about cocaine and what it does to you on the road. It's a sickness born deep inside my soul. I mean, he's not talking about traffic lines there. He's talking about about something else. Swinging doors, you know, I think I'll just sit here and drink. You don't have to figure out what that is. Mama Try. You know, that's a song that very clearly tells you about the failing. The failure he was, and how disappointed his mother was, and his dad, you know, poor old dad, as he says in the song. It's an endless. You can run through that catalog and be amazed that Merle wrote this. Merle Haggard wrote that. The song he did with Willie Nelson. Many songs, but he did a Dylan song with Willie Nelson after that. Ooh, and he did, Pancho and Lefty.
Great record that is.
Great, great record. They didn't write it, but it's such a perfect song for the two of them.
Their voices together on that record, that's one of the great records.
And they recorded it separately. They weren't in the same studio. You know, Merle was in Texas, stopped off at Willie's ranch. And Willie had a whole bunch of new songs. And he said, Merle, let's lay a few tracks down. So the first song that Willie had was the one that Elvis had recorded.
Always on My Mind.
On My Mind, right. And beautiful. I think one of the most beautiful songs, especially when Willie did it. Merle said, I don't like that song. It doesn't do anything for me. You had recorded by yourself, and Willie did was the biggest song.
Gigantic hit, yeah.
But the one song that Merle did like was Pancho and Lefty. So in order to prepare to do it, they stayed up for 5 days drinking and then cleansing their body, crazy stuff they did. And then they went into the studio at 3 o'clock in the morning for Merle to do his part. And then after Merle did it, went to his trailer, Willie did his part. And when Merle woke up the next day, they were going to play golf. He said, I want to redo my part because I don't think I got it exactly right. And Willie said, it's already in New York. It's already being mixed. And that song you hear came from that visit. Merle and Willie.
I can't imagine that he sang it any better than that.
Hard to imagine.
Yeah.
And Willie sang it with Paul Simon once. And, he said, where's Merle?
Yeah.
Merle.
Well, I mean, I love Paul Simon's voice, but there's a certain resonance and quality to Merle's voice that is...
Yeah, I mean, Paul Simon is an urban New York voice, sweet and great, great musician. No, don't get me wrong, but
Pancho, it's a very different thing.
That's a country song. That's a rough and tough outlaw song, rural. And, it was a good try, but then again, Merle never recorded any Paul Simon songs.
That's true. He never did a tribute to Paul Simon. Did do a tribute to Elvis. I like that Farewell to Elvis. That was a record I liked.
Great album. And as I said before, Elvis was an influence. He was one of those, maybe I didn't say it before, but he was one of those influences, like Crosby, like Dean Martin, who influenced Elvis and who in turn influenced Merle. And you can hear a lot of that. When you can hear that close miking, that warbling, that kind of intimacy that Merle was able to achieve because he had great teachers. The radio was his university.
And when did he first pick up the guitar? When he was just a kid?
His mother, he was the fourth child. So the first two children were already grown when he was born. The third was stillborn. And Flossie May, who was a devout Christian, believed that for some reason they were being punished. They did something wrong. So she vowed never to have children again. But a few years later, she got pregnant with his father, Jim, and gave birth to Merle. So she believed that Merle was a gift from God. And she was a little older. The father was already working at the railroads. And so she was less strict and less doctrinaire than she was with the older children. And she kind of encouraged Merle to be the special boy that she thought he was. And Merle's father played the fiddle, but he wasn't allowed to play it after they got married because it was not God's way, except in church. And one day she gave Merle the father's fiddle after the father died and said, maybe this will put him in the right, put him on the right road. But Merle didn't, at that point, he had no interest in the fiddle. And then a year or two later, his older brother, who was working in a gas station, filled up some guy's tank, and he didn't have enough money to pay for the gas, so he gave the brother a guitar as payment. He brought the guitar home and gave it to Merle, and Merle fell in love with it. This was something, he fell in love with it because all his heroes played it. Even Bing played a little ukulele. And this was something that spoke to him. And that's when he began playing it. By the time he was 15 or 16, he was playing in bars. He would sit in with a band and just play. And he was a very good guitar player, like Springsteen, a guitar player before he was a singer. And everybody in the bars knew him. And were always after him to come up and play because he was so good. And girls went gaga over him. Like, he was young. He looked like James Dean. He could play the guitar. He was rough and tough, a real bad boy. And women just flocked to him almost his whole life. He didn't age that well. But even so, when he had that Svengali thing, when he got on stage with that voice, his ability to play. He got better and better and better as the years went by. Roy Nichols, his lead guitarist, who did all those great openings, like down, out, down, out, bum, bum, da, 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 da. All those things Roy Nichols did. And Merle Nichols, who had been Lefty Frizzell's guitar player, taught Merle how to play the Telecaster because Merle was mostly an acoustic guitar player. So he taught him that, and that opened up another whole world for Merle, the electric Telecaster. And he learned, he was pretty good by the end. He could play. And he also taught himself how to play fiddle because Bob Wills played it. And he drove everybody crazy because he practiced 16 hours a day on it. And people said he would just walk around back and forth trying to play the fiddle, and everybody just went crazy. I mean, as soon as the bus would pull into it, they'd all scatter, get to their hotel rooms just to get away from it. But he learned it, he learned it, and he was pretty good at it. So, some of it is so delightful. Some of the stories, so you laugh out loud when you read it. Some of it, not so funny.
Well, you do a wonderful job of bringing him to life on this page, and it's, like I said, I think a book that you have a lot of passion for, and that comes through. So congratulations on it, Mark Elliott. The book is called The Hag, The Lifetimes and Music of Merle Haggard and the Author of the Brilliant. Mark Elliott, it's always a pleasure to speak with you, Mark.
Great to see you and speak with you. See you, fun. And I always enjoy our talks because they're real talks and not the usual stuff that promotion demands.
Well, thank you for that. I look forward to your next one.
Yeah, I know what it is, but I don't want to say it yet. But you'll find out.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.